Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm Robin Buller, your host. Today we will be talking with Professor Anika Valka, who is joining us from Washington University in St. Louis. She will be talking to us about her book, Pioneers and Partisans, an Oral History of Nazi Genocide in Belorussia. Anika, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's a real pleasure to have you. I'm looking forward to our discussion. Before we get into actually talking about Pioneers and Partisans, I wonder if you could tell our listeners a little bit about yourself.
Well, I think what's important for this project to know is that I was born and raised in the GDR, in East Germany, a country that doesn't exist anymore at this time. But that's also the place where I learned Russian. I learned Russian in high school there for 10 years. And then in the year of 2001, I was an exchange student in St. Petersburg in Russia, which is where I encountered many of the Jewish survivors of the Nazi genocide that I then began to interview and that are kind of the subject of the book. So the year 2000 was a very important moment in the German post-war history in the sense that this was the first time that the German government or any German government really had agreed to pay out some kind of symbolic compensation payments to survivors of forced labor for the Nazi regime. So that law was passed in the summer of 2000. And so right around after that time, I went to St. Petersburg. And I was interested in that topic because I had been kind of studying how German post-war society had addressed the Nazi past for quite a while. And I'd been involved in some groups of activists around issues of compensation and recognition for Nazi persecution. So I was very curious to learn how survivors of Nazi persecution actually perceived the fact that there finally was this kind of recognition, but it also came 60 years after the end of the war. So my interest in German post-war society and how it dealt with the aftermath of the Nazi past was very much an outcome actually of my political activism around refugee policy and asylum policy at the time. When a lot of what we see now, kind of in a very intensive form, kind of the migrant deaths in the Mediterranean Sea, many immigrants trying to reach Europe to claim asylum, was already a problem, became increasingly a pressing issue because the European Union had passed a number of laws and concluded treaties to kind of limit immigration and especially refugee immigration at the time. And so there was a number of activists in Germany who were trying to address that issue, but also were trying to understand why is that? Why do societies try to cut off themselves against immigration so aggressively, if you will? And so for the German context, of course, one of the contexts that you kind of stumble upon really quickly was the aftermath of the Nazi past and kind of the continuities of racism and xenophobia, the formation of a society that kind of assumes a position of supremacy toward others. So that was kind of the background of my engagement with the history of the Nazi regime. And at the same time, the late 1990s was the time when the so-called Berlin Republic emerged, the reunified Germany, and debates about Holocaust memory were very, very prominent, were very much on everybody's mind. especially after the German military, the Bundeswehr, for the first time since the end of World War II, had been deployed out of area to the Kosovo, namely. And some of those debates had revealed a continuously problematic relationship between Germans and Jews. And so for me, going to St. Petersburg in the year 2000 was very much informed by some of these issues and trying to understand how do people outside of Germany, and especially in countries that had suffered from the Nazi regime, from Nazi occupation, were relating to some of these debates. So as a student, I was at the State University of St. Petersburg at the time. I also contacted a number of survivors in St. Petersburg to kind of learn how they thought about German politics of memory, about these compensation payments, and then essentially started to volunteer and helping to provide translations of some of the documentation that people had to provide to claim some of these symbolic payments. And this is where I learned a story of what we now call the Holocaust that was very different than what most people know and that I knew at the time. So we often think about deportations from Germany, from Western Europe to Eastern Europe and kind of the killings in extermination camps like Auschwitz or Treblinka or Majdanek. But the stories that I learned from these Soviet survivors were very, very different in the sense that these people talked about the persecution of their communities and their destruction actually at home, literally in their hometowns. But then, of course, they also talked about the kind of post-war Soviet politics of memory that were also very, very different and made it impossible for many of them to ever actually talk about their past. And so I kind of started to interview these people because I thought at least we should document these stories before people pass away. And essentially became, when I was a little historian, it wasn't my plan at the time. But so since then, I've essentially studied more and more the Soviet Union and its successor states, the history and memory of war and genocidal violence in this area. And in particular, I'm interested in kind of the experience, representation, and memory of Jews in this context, because as you may know, Eastern Europe was one of the centers of Jewish life in Europe before World War II. And at the same time, Jews have continuously experienced moments of policies and practices of exclusion and social experimentation. And in some ways, that history, I think, really challenges us to think about issues of multinational integration, but also about how institutions and individuals facilitate change and make sense of the world, because the Soviet history of communism, internationalism, but also the experience of World War II, of course, raise a lot of these issues in a very, very stark ways that I find very important to understand. So now for a couple of years, since 2014, I'm on a tenure track position at Washington University here in St. Louis, where I teach Soviet history, but also have classes on the history and memory of World War II and the Holocaust, and violence. But we also learn about gender, sexuality, and communism, and issues of migration. These are kind of topics that have been on my mind for a long time, and I'm very, very glad to be able to pass on some of the information that I've gathered and some of the analysis that I've encountered over time to pass that on to my students and now to readers.
Yeah, it seems like a project that really has deep roots. And you mentioned that that you first encountered some of these stories about killings in people's hometowns when you were in St. Petersburg. So with that in mind, what drew you to studying Soviet youth during this period in Belarusia? And what questions did you set out to answer when you started this project?
I mean, as I said, I met a number of people who would later become essentially my interlocutors, my interviewees, through my work in the Association of Survivors of Ghettos and Concentration Camps. And when they talked about their experiences, both of the pre-war period, but also of the wartime, I really understood that there was something different than what we had known about World War II and about the Holocaust at the time, and was very curious to learn more about that. So in some ways, when I decided to start interviewing these people in 2001, spring of 2001 was the first time that I began to interview survivors. On one hand, I really wanted to know the history of the German occupation, the Nazi genocide, and the Holocaust in Soviet territories, and in particular in Belarus. which alongside Ukraine, as you may know, has had actually suffered the most under the German occupations during the Nazi period. So I was really interested in how people had experienced, but also understood this time of war and genocide, and how they lived on after the war. So how their experiences during the war affected their lives after the war, how they rebuilt personal lives after often immense losses, but also after often finding new communities during the war. So throughout interviewing people about their lives, of course, questions of memory and how do people represent their past became more and more pressing in a sense, because when people talk about their lives, they don't necessarily talk about it as or in the same way as it actually happened. Like, we have to think about, why do people talk about their lives in particular ways? What are some of the issues that affect how people understand their lives? How do they interpret their experiences? And so for me, the question really was, how do these Jewish survivors of the Holocaust remember almost six decades after the war? I actually came pretty late to them, if you will. How do they remember their past in a situation of intense social and political change? I mean, this was after Perestroika. This was after the Soviet Union had broken apart. This was after the end of Cold War tensions. And it was in a context of liberalization within the post-Soviet space, if you will, of national identities being revived and redefined, Jewish life communally as well as individually had really experienced a moment of revitalization after many decades of marginalization and partly state-supported anti-Semitism. So all of these kind of played into this attempt to understand how people think about their own past and what can we learn from that.
And I mean, oral testimony is such an enormously important source for Holocaust scholars, of course, and it can be immensely rich and at times problematic. I mean, you've already mentioned the difficulties that come with conducting interviews with someone about an event that happened six decades ago. And in your book, you're really open and candid about the opportunities and the challenges that come with working with oral material. So I wonder if you could tell us how you engaged with oral testimony over the course of your research.
I mean, generally, I think we have to think about oral testimony as something that's actually relatively new as a historical method. It really came to fruition as an accepted method, although there are still some people who think it's not a valid method. Mm-hmm. In the last few decades, especially if you think in terms of the Holocaust and the Nazi genocide and the Nazi regime, for a long time, the focus really was on the perpetrators and on trying to understand the system of persecution, the system of the Nazi regime and how it implemented its policies. So only in about the 60s and 70s, so after the Eichmann trial and in many ways, there were more and more scholars interested in actually the victim side, if you will, kind of the complement to the perpetrators, although some of these categories, although have increasingly become questioned, and joined kind of a larger trend in the historical profession to think about kind of the social aspects of history, to think about people and their everyday life, how they experience history, how they facilitate and participate in historical change. And so Holocaust studies in many ways has joined that trend to try to understand how ordinary people, if you will, experienced the Nazi regime, has responded to it, both as individuals and as communities. How did they try to survive? How did they deal with loss and mourning? How did they manage to rebuild their lives after the war? And through that, also to understand how different people, how diverse experiences actually could be during the war. Often people think about one kind of role model, if you will, of wartime experience. But if you really look closely, you understand that children and youth, women and men, people with disabilities who are capable, people of different classes have very, very different experiences. And so oral testimonies, oral history, really has managed to access some of these experiences that are otherwise not documented. I mean, you can go to archives, and for the most part, you won't necessarily find documents that would help you understand these particular and very diverse experiences.
Right.
And so for the Soviet context that I was working with, this was especially relevant, where on one hand, very few documents are actually left, were left behind about the experience of the German occupation generally, in part because the destruction was so huge. But then also the politics of memory after the war did not give a lot of space to experience that were not in line with the kind of legitimate Soviet war portrayal, which very much focused on the heroic military struggle of a unified Soviet population. But what we're looking at here really are people who weren't necessarily asked, who weren't members of the military, who were Jews, who weren't allowed to speak about the Holocaust as an experience different than the experience of most Soviet citizens. We're also talking about the experiences of youth and children, who for the most part also were not really included in kind of the creation of a narrative about the war. So there were very few documents actually are available in memoirs from people who survived the German occupation in the Soviet territories. Although we are actually discovering more and more materials. My colleague Jochen Helbig, for instance, at Rutgers University, has uncovered a number of documents from a historical commission of the Communist Party that actually went around Soviet territories beginning in 1943 and interviewing citizens, professionals who were there during the occupation. And
wow,
as I am looking at these testimonies with him together now, we actually learn quite a bit about the overall impact on the violence on Soviet citizens more broadly, which of course Jewish citizens belong to as well. So trying to pry these apart, these different experiences, is one of the very exciting moments, I think, at this point in scholarship on the Holocaust and the Soviet Union. But I'm detracting from your question. You actually asked me about how I did my oral history.
No, it's really fascinating too, because it shows that, I mean, even if oral testimony is a new source in a new-ish source among Holocaust historians, it was being conducted long before, or at least during this time period itself. But yeah, how did you go about conducting interviews and using oral testimony in this particular project?
Yeah, so I met a number of the people who would later then become my interviewers through volunteering in the association, where I did Association of Survivors, where I did some translations, but where I was also invited to join holiday celebrations on May 9th, for instance, to celebrate the anniversary of the liberation from the Nazi regime, but also some Jewish holidays I was invited to. I'd met some of these people over multiple occasions. And then it was actually fairly easy for me to ask them if they would be willing to talk about their lives in some more detail with me and actually give me somewhat more formalized interviews. Which I did. I began in the spring of 2001, somewhat of an ad hoc endeavor, because I had not planned to doing that project and actually had to cobble together a microphone and a recording device, kind of the basic things. But I think in the end, it was all a good experience, because it really brought me down to the basics of what does it mean to do oral history, and think about it very carefully. How can you document people's lives in an ethical way with very, very basic means? So I started to interview people in like April 2001. And then some of them suggested, oh, you should talk to this person, you should talk to that person. But I also had a good relationship to the leadership of the association, who was also willing to support me in trying to identify people that were willing to talk to me. So I did a number of interviews in St. Petersburg in that time period, but then also came back a year later, and then I also traveled to Belarus, because I realized that most of the people I interviewed who had lived in St. Petersburg for many, many decades actually originated in Belarus, or what is now the Republic of Belarus. At the time, it was the Soviet Belarusian Republic, and began to interview people there. And essentially, the interviews were very, very open. I essentially let people talk and tell me their life stories. So I asked very few questions, in part because I was a scholar who had good background knowledge, but I actually knew not very much at the time about really what had happened in the Soviet territories. I was studying that at the same time as I was doing these interviews, primarily because I was worried that people would pass away soon. So I asked very few questions and let people essentially talk about their lives, and would then later go back and have the chance to ask more questions at the end of the interview or multiple times. I developed quite intensive personal relationships with some of these people and was able to interview them multiple times. But of course, people knew what I was interested in. They knew how I met them. I had met them through the Association of Survivors. So they kind of knew that I was interested in their wartime experience, and that often was the focus of the conversations. And in many ways, it was actually difficult to encourage people to tell me more about themselves before the war. That's something that I thought was actually important to understand, because in order to understand how people react to a crisis like war, like a genocide, you actually need to know who they are a little bit. So over multiple encounters, over multiple meetings, we were often able to come to a moment when people were really open and talking about their lives. And I think the book really shows that as well, in the sense that it allowed me then to trace multiple people over many years. That it did not start with the war in 1941 and doesn't end in the war in 1944, but it gives a little bit more context to also understand how people live with the aftermath of these experiences. But generally, the interviews were, again, very, very open, very flexible. I did not use a camera. I only taped them. For those who have seen some video testimonies, you may understand that often these interviews are very different in the sense that they're more performance than an interview where for the first time people answer to some questions. So I'm very interested in getting these stories, these narratives that aren't kind of pre-shaped by anything else. And for many people that I did interview, it was the first time that they ever spoke about their lives in that way.
And so let's start talking about what you found during these interviews. So your book sort of opens after you discuss your methodology with an examination of how the interviewees remembered life before the Holocaust, which, as you mentioned, is important to understand. So how did they experience Sovietization?
To some extent, I have to say this was actually unplanned. I wasn't planning on writing a book at the time at all, but I also wasn't necessarily, I didn't go out to interview people about their lives in the 1930s and about living as a Jew in a series of contexts, but I was more interested in the wartime period. During their narrations about the wartime period, they often made references to before, to the time before the war, to relationships that they had built with friends, with classmates, with neighbors, with their teachers, people that they just encountered on a daily basis, and described that often as very positive experiences, as very close relationships, friendships, but that then remained became very, very important actually during the war, in the sense that these people would continue to help them, that they would continue to be friends with them, even though the overall context, the German occupation and Nazi racism, actually had told people not to. It had told people that Jews are the enemy and needed to be destroyed. And so I became increasingly interested in the pre-war period as a moment in which personal relationships were built that then enabled particular responses, and we can talk about that more during the war. So I started to study more about the pre-war period, because most of my interviewees were born in the 1920s, late 1920s, early 1930s, so they were very young actually at the beginning of the war. But they'd all grown up in what used to be the Jewish Pale of Settlement, the part of the Russian Empire where Jewish subjects of the Tsar were supposed to live. Jewish people were not allowed to live anywhere else. So it was really one of the centers of Jewish life in the Russian Empire. And even after 1917, after in the course of the Russian revolutions, these restrictions had been lifted. Many Jews remained in that place. Many Jews remained in the region, although many also left and moved to Leningrad, moved to Moscow, moved to Kiev, to the larger cities, because they saw better opportunities for themselves there, or had relatives that had left immediately with the revolution. But so during the 1920s and 1930s, of course, in the course of the Soviet, the young Soviet Union's attempt to build a new society, we're also looking at a process of attacks on religious institutions, on the, I mean, in the end, the destruction of official public Jewish culture, problems that some of my colleagues, like Zvi Gitelman or Anna Sternschuss or Lisa Pemperat and Bruce Loyne, have elaborated upon in very, very detailed ways. So the 1920s and 1930s really were was a time when Jewish life as it had existed in the Pale of Settlement fell apart, essentially. So many of the interlocutors of mine experienced the Sovietization process as a moment of secularization and Sovietization, where essentially their Jewish identity didn't really mean anything for them personally. many Jews had left, they had moved to cities, but they also experienced kind of a process of urbanization, integration into Soviet societies. And for many of the parents of my interlocutors, that was very much what was going on, is to leave what we call the shtetl, the kind of Jewish communities that were closely knit, that lived according to Jewish customs and traditions. But for these young Soviet citizens, Jewish religion and culture was not necessarily very meaningful anymore. They learned in Soviet schools. They spoke Russian or Belarusian. Some even didn't learn Yiddish at all, which in the early 2000s, many of them regretted that they didn't know their own culture as they articulated it. But many of them still encountered Jewish religion through their grandparents. So, for example, Boris Galperin or Elena Drabkina, some of the actors, if you will, of my book, talk about their relationships to their grandparents, who were still going to the synagogue on a regular basis, who were following Kashrut and so forth. But for them, that often seemed kind of somewhat mysterious and not interesting. They were more interested in being part of Soviet youth culture. So they were pioneers, they were engaged in sports, they participated in other youth projects. And so for them, they really saw themselves as fully respected members of Soviet society. And so in some ways, my interviews reveal that the Soviet promise of equality, of integration, had actually worked, that these people saw themselves as part of something larger of overall society, that they saw themselves as having opportunities in terms of education and professions, that they emphasized inter-ethnic friendships, where ethnic backgrounds or national backgrounds didn't mean anything, especially not negatively. But of course, the question also is that remembered as such, or is that really the reality? Because we do have other scholars, we have other scholarship that talks about some of the difficulties that Jews in the Soviet context experience, especially those who did not agree with that project, who wanted to remain religious, who wanted to follow religious traditions, and who other people who suffered from anti-Semitic harassment at the workplace. I mean, there are these other narratives. So in some ways, of course, I could say that these were young people and they went to school, and for them that really was the experience, that they felt fully included. But it could also be that that's a portrayal of the 1930s that is potentially more positive than they would have said at the time, because of what they experienced later, and especially of what they experienced during the German occupation, where racism really divided people into different groups, where some were supposed to survive and some were supposed to die, where other people were discriminated against. Or it could also be in contrast to the post-war experience of Soviet anti-Semitism, where some of them actually do talk about the fact that they did not have access to the university in a way that they wanted, or that they didn't get the job that they wanted, but that they felt stigmatized as Jews in the Soviet context. So in a way, the experience of the 1930s here is potentially more positive because of what came after. And that's some of the, these are some of the issues that I think about in the book when I talk about issues of memory and identity. How do people see themselves in relationship to larger society, to other people? And how does that affect how they talk about their own lives?
Right. So their memories of this period could almost be colored by nostalgia.
If you will.
Of sorts.
I mean, nostalgia is always often something or an affect about something that actually didn't exist, right?
Okay, right.
So, it could be nostalgia. It could be the reality. I mean, it's and in some ways it is the reality because that's how they remember. So it is their reality.
Right, right. And so let's move into this transition then into the period of Nazi rule, and you show how the lives of these individuals changed dramatically. Specifically, you focus on the experiences of Jewish youth in the Minsk ghetto. So what were your findings about these ghetto experiences?
I mean, you're definitely right in saying that the Minsk ghetto has not received as much attention as many other ghettos. If we think, for example, Warsaw or Łódź in Poland or even Kraków, there really is a different story here to some extent that is very much related to, I think, the overall context of the German attack against the Soviet Union, which has been discussed by many, many scholars. I'm not going into too much detail, but I think what is important to know and to be aware of as we are exploring Jewish lives during the German occupation is that this war began as a surprise. And again, scholars have talked at length about the fact that Stalin or the Soviet government probably was aware that the German attack might be impending, but didn't really do anything because they didn't really believe in it. All of that to say is it didn't actually mean much for people on the ground. They were surprised when German troops on June the 22nd in 1941 crossed the border between Eastern Poland and the Soviet Union at the time. And didn't know what to do for the most part. There was no preparation for evacuation. The Soviet military was largely incapacitated or unprepared. So within very few days, German troops actually had reached Minsk, which is quite a distance away from the border. But within 3 or 4 days, air raids took place that destroyed Minsk to a large extent, and people were desperately trying to save their lives. And the other thing that people didn't know, in addition to the fact that this attack would happen and was a possibility, is that the German plans for the war were very, very detailed. The so-called Generalplan Ost, or Master Plan East in English, was planning essentially the destruction of about 30 million people in the Soviet Union. Because for them, Eastern Europe, and especially the territories of the Soviet Union, were seen as so-called living space, as a space where they could extract resources for the survival of the Aryan population of Germans. But they could also only make use of these resources if the population that actually lived in that space was gone, or for the most part was gone. So the Master Plan East really operated on the assumption that many, many million people would die, and especially in urban centers, which if you look at Belarus, or what is now the Republic of Belarus, targeted Jews to a large extent, because at the time about 30 or sometimes even 40% of the population in Belarusia was Jewish. So we have a war that really is a war of extermination, that is not, quote unquote, just a war to conquer territory and overrun a certain power structure, but it really was a war that was designed to destroy and acquire resources for somebody else who wasn't there. So very, very quickly with the German invasion, the policies essentially prescribed by this plan were set in place. And you have very quickly in the summer of 1941, the beginning of systematic arrests, detentions, and shootings and killings. So for Jews, especially in the Minsk area, that meant, for instance, that in late July, the ghetto was established, or they called the Jewish residential district, but factually it is what we now call the ghetto, meaning about 70,000, although scholars have very, very contradicting ideas here, because we don't actually know who was there, because people had tried to leave and then came back. From Eastern Poland had fled to Belarus after 1939. But about 70,000 Jews were moved into a very small space in Minsk that was also heavily destroyed. So they had to essentially find a place to live in small houses, and often many, many families shared one room amongst each other. And as some of my interviews describe it, they literally slept on and underneath the table. So it was a very, very crowded space. But of course, first of all, being confined to the ghetto was based on the identification as other, as somebody else who doesn't belong to the rest of the population. So this really was the moment when many of the people that I interviewed realized that they were different, meaning that they were Jews. They were not just Soviet citizens, but they were also Jews that in that case could be persecuted and discriminated against. So the ghetto was established in late July. Inmates of the ghetto were forced to work. Male youth beginning at the age of 14, female youth beginning at the age of 16 were supposed to work. And essentially only workers received food. So of course you have a large population of both children and elderly, or people who are physically incapable of working, who don't have access to regular food. So starvation became an issue very, very quickly. But also beginning in August 1941, you have systematic killing actions, often literally in the streets of the ghetto, but then followed beginning in November 1941 by essentially roundups of these districts within the ghetto, where on one hand, in November 1st, 18,000 people, and at a later date, over 15,000 people were rounded up and taken to shooting or killing sites just outside of town to decimate the ghetto population, because German Jews from multiple German cities were being deported from their hometowns into Belarusian, or at that point, German-occupied territory, in preparation of their extermination, of course. So beginning in the fall, in the late summer, early fall, we have a number of large-scale killing actions of local Jews, if you will, literally outside of town, which also, of course, means that locals knew about what was going on. The local population knew what was going on. And this is one of the very important differences between the Holocaust in the Soviet territories in the Holocaust, let's say, in Western Europe or in Germany, where the killings didn't take place there, but far away in Eastern Europe after people had been deported, right? So if you look at the Minsk ghetto, essentially, you get a sense of the beginning of the Holocaust in late summer 1941 with really the destruction of Jewish communities. And that has shifted a little bit the timeline that people often operated upon of the Holocaust, of the systematic extermination of European Jewry, where it began essentially with these mass killings with bullets or with gas bans, but not in the gas chambers of Auschwitz, that are much more prominent, that were much more knowable as what we call the Holocaust. But so the Minsk ghetto essentially is one of the primary sites of this extermination into Soviet territories, where especially non-workers, so women, children, the elderly, were often targeted by these regular raids. But so by January 1943, you have about 6,000 people who are still alive, which of course is a huge difference to the about 80,000, 70 to 80,000 in the summer of 1941. And then in the spring of 1943, you have more and more kind of small-scale killing actions of individual worker groups, and many people trying to leave the ghetto. Actually, beginning in 1941, people try to leave, but especially in the spring of 1943, there's a much more systematic or almost organized escape waves out of the Minsk ghetto. Up until October 1943, when the Minsk ghetto was completely destroyed, when the last 1,500 inmates were also killed in the last weeks of October. So in essence, just to summarize this, and if you look at the Minsk ghetto that is kind of exemplary, if you will, for the Holocaust in the Soviet territories, somewhat different than many of the ghettos that we knew about before, especially in Poland, which often existed for quite a long time, for multiple years, where people were forced to work, but were often also told that if they work for the German war economy, they would survive. Although, of course, there's some conflicts around these issues. But the other difference that you have in the Soviet ghettos, and in particular in Minsk, is that given the policies of secularization and the destruction of Jewish organized culture before the war, there is no real Jewish self-organization available. There is no organized Jewish community. So people were really left to fend for themselves and had to rebuild some of these communities of support during the war. And I think it had really an impact on their chances of survivals and the way that people survived. In this context of immediate killing, essentially after the invasion, but so by late summer, early fall 1941, first groups of resistance actually emerged. But the interesting part is that they also often operated in collaboration with activists outside of the ghetto, so with non-Jewish activists who both benefited from the resistance cells that existed in the ghetto. In the sense that they often brought or were able to smuggle items that were useful for the resistance from the workshops that they were working in, because many Jews were working in German ammunition workshops or weaponry workshops, or were sewing clothing, working as cobblers. So they had access to some goods that were actually important for people outside of the ghetto as well. But on the other hand, there was also collaboration across the ghetto fence, if you will, to try to rescue Jewish children that were placed in an orphanage just outside of the ghetto, but also to bring out a number of Jews from the ghetto and then try to place them into partisan units that had emerged outside of Minsk. So there was very, very quickly, there was this recognition that we have to do something and we have to figure out how to save people, because the killing took place so quickly. I think people realized that this was not just, just in quotation marks, of course, a prison. It was actually a place that served a different purpose in the extermination. And so in the chapter, you will read a lot about ways that people tried to save themselves. Often that included hiding in so-called malinas, which are kind of hiding places built in attics and basements behind fake walls, so that they would survive some of the roundups in the ghetto. But you'll also read about escape attempts, so people trying to leave the ghetto. And the focus, of course, given my interlocutors, is youth and children who suffered from this persecution, but who also had some chances to survive. So essentially, one of my arguments is that youth and children were, on one hand, the most vulnerable, but they were also the most resourceful inmates of the ghetto, and most vulnerable in the sense that they, of course, were targeted by these killing actions because they were not working. And they were starving, they were affected by hunger in very, very different ways. But they were also very mobile. They could slip through the ghetto fence. They could beg for food outside of the ghetto. They often received help from friends, from adults, and so had access to means of survival that adults didn't necessarily have, right? So many of the orphans that I write about really talk about some of these experiences of trying to save themselves and how they interacted with some of the resistance efforts that did exist as well in the ghetto, But they also talk about the rescue operations that were put in place by a number of different actors within the ghetto, and for which actually many of the children themselves were very, very important, because they were often the ones who were leading people out of the ghetto because they could slip through ghetto fences and other issues.
And how were the experiences, these more urban experiences of persecution, rescue, escape, how do those compare to what you found about experiences of destruction in Eastern Belarus?
So the Minsk Plan, as I said, existed from the summer of 1941 to October of 1943, so a little bit over 2 years, which meant that for people who had work and who managed to survive, there was a chance to survive, especially if they managed to escape in 1943. But many of the rural areas, especially in eastern Belarus, which is one of the foci of my book, the ghettos that were established there, if they were established, often didn't exist that long at all. In many ways, they were established essentially a day or two before people were rounded up and taken to the execution. And in part, that is because the rural areas in eastern Belarus, or even the somewhat more urbanized places like Babruysk, had very few industrial facilities left. So forced labor wasn't really something that the Germans were interested in there. So in many places, the local population was asked to just continue to work as they did. But often there was no kind of structured exploitation for the German war economy like we had seen it in Minsk. And labor or work, like cleaning the streets, cutting trees and so on, were often more used as kind of a form of punishment, but not because they were actually seen as useful. So Jews, in that sense, in the German logic, weren't useful. They weren't necessary as labor at all. They were merely a population to be destroyed. So beginning in the fall, early fall 1941, many of these Jewish communities, meaning often the 30 or some so percent of local populations, were rounded up and shot literally right outside their hometowns and forests, at pits that were dug a day before, or kind of anti-tank trenches were often used for this. So the killing there began very quickly in fall 1941, and in most places actually was concluded in the spring of 1942. So the majority of the Jewish population that had fallen under German occupation had been exterminated by the spring of 1942. So in that sense, Minsk is actually already an exception, even though it's already occupied. Poland. But so you essentially have a situation now where almost every small town, village even, in the Republic of Belarus, has a killing site somewhere nearby, has mass graves nearby, who are often not necessarily marked. That's kind of an effect or result of Soviet politics of memory after the war. And so one of the things that scholars are currently doing, and I hope to some extent my work contributes to that as well, but there's also a French organization called Yihad in Unum that some listeners may be aware of, are trying to document these sites, are trying to mark these sites and then try to figure out who was actually killed where and when, because in many ways we don't know that. So there's often survivors like Grigory Ehrenburg, one of the actors in the book, who don't know exactly when and where their relatives died, when they were killed, and don't have a place to go to, if you will, to grieve, to mourn the losses. So that's, again, an issue that I'm trying to discuss. What does it actually mean if you know your relatives are dead, but you don't know where they are, you don't know how they died? And that's a very troubling question, I mean, for all of us, I think, just to imagine that. So what does that mean to not have a place, not have certainty about death, about loss? And how does that impact the way in which people talk about these experiences? They often barely escaped, essentially, right? So on one hand, the destruction in the rural areas took place very, very quickly and in very, very brutal ways that are often not necessarily documented. And on the other hand, in terms of survival, where in Minsk, as I said, many people were able to leave the ghetto. We're talking about approximately 10,000 people who managed to leave the ghetto. But in these rural areas, that was much, much more difficult, and very few people managed to flee, often literally from the site of execution, and then managed to survive in hiding or as part of the Soviet partisan movement, which I think we can talk a little bit about, talk more about.
Yeah, perhaps we should move on to the partisan movement. Actually, that's a great transition. I found this section particularly fascinating. So what were the experiences of, you know, some of these people who were at the time Jewish youth in the Soviet partisans, and how does that fit into your arguments about identity, you know, Soviet identity, Jewish identity?
I mean, the Soviet partisan movement, which is essentially, for American listeners who don't know what partisans are, they're essentially guerrilla fighters. These are essentially people who are not necessarily trained militarily. But beginning in the summer of 1941, the Soviet government encouraged people behind the front line, so civilians, but also especially Soviet soldiers who had been separated from their units, to take up the fight against the German occupants. And in the end, there were about 380,000 people who were fighting in the partisan movement in what is now the Republic of Belarus. So these were people who were essentially hiding in the forests, in the swamps, who were living in dugouts in the woods, who were collecting food wherever they could, often from the local populations, which is laden with conflict, as you can imagine. But so over the years, this became a substantial movement of people being essentially behind the front line and sabotaging the German occupation, but also then becoming more and more relevant for the Soviet military as a decisive factor. And so many Jews who were able to flee the ghettos were trying to join the units or detachments of the partisan movement, because they knew that this is essentially the only place where they can survive, where you have access to food and basic necessities, but you can also defend yourself against the German military, if you will. But unfortunately, many Jews were not able to be admitted into these units because some commanders were anti-Semites. They didn't like Jews. Some didn't want to burden themselves with civilians who were not trained in military combat, who would slow things down, who didn't have any skills that were necessary to, let's say, place mines and so forth. So very few Jews actually managed to be incorporated in these units. As a result of,
and I guess some people would have been very young, some of the people that you,
some of them were very young. I mean, some of them were 14 by the time, 15, but yeah, they were also very, very young. So some people that I talked to managed to access one of these units and then participated in combat there, which for the most part, I would say, in terms of their identity, kind of reinforced their commitment to the Soviet state and reinforced kind of their Soviet identity rather than the Jewish identity, which really had brought them there in the first place because they were persecuted as Jews. But then on the other hand, there were also a number of people who didn't find access to these units. So there were some Jewish combat units that were established by people like Hirsch Kaplinsky or Israel Lapidus, some people may have heard of. But there were also a number of people who really weren't able to participate in combat, like children, people who had been hurt, or women who were not, didn't feel comfortable in a sense. So there were these so-called family units, Jewish family units, that some of the listeners may have heard about in terms of the so-called Bielski unit. Was the subject of Nehama textbook Defiance, which then also was used to make a film with Daniel Craig in the leading role. But so I'm writing about one particular Jewish unit under the leadership of Sholem Zordon, which was established near Minsk. I mean, still 80 kilometers from Minsk, but close by enough that people could reach it on foot from the Minsk ghetto. And in the end, there were about 600 Jewish civilians, if you will, in this unit. 280 of them were female, 240 younger than 20, and also many, many orphans, about 30 to 40 orphans, which were often under 10 years old, who kind of survived in this unit as a place of rescue. For them, it was really the safe haven. But at the same time, this unit also fulfilled a very important function for the Soviet partisan movement as a whole, in the sense that they provided food. They had a dairy, they had a mill, but they also had cobblers, they had locksmiths, workshops. So they prepared ammunition and clothing that was then useful for Soviet combatants of the partisan movement. They had a hospital. They had very, very important medical aid was provided in this unit. So the unit was both a site of rescue, but also of support for the Soviet partisan movement. And for many of my interlocutors, it was also the place, I think, where they really realized that they were part of a Jewish community, because it really was a Jewish unit. So in a way, you kind of have the opposite experience compared to the rural areas in eastern Belarus, where before the war, you often had kind of remnants of the Jewish community, of kind of the shtetl life, but where survivors of the killing actions often only found rescue in these Soviet units, where they often had to disguise their Jewish identity. But here you have the opposite, where you have an urban space before the war where people had essentially given up on their Jewish identity for the most part. But now during the war, we're kind of rediscovering that Jewish identity. So the Zorin unit is an interesting case study, I think, both of survival, but also of the creation of identity in the face of extreme violence.
And then your conclusion brings us back to, you know, what happened to the memory of this event, this trauma, as well as resistance and rescue in the after, the post-war period. So what can you tell us about how these survivors, how these Jewish youth experienced memory of the war, memory of their trauma over the next few decades?
I mean, concretely for members of the Zorin unit, it's actually a very, very unfortunate story, in the sense that even though in the Soviet Union, the memory of the partisan movement, of the military struggle against the German occupation was very, very important for the kind of reestablishment of Soviet society and Soviet identity, the Zorin unit, but also the Bielski unit, were not recognized as part of the partisan movement, because the argument was that they did not participate in combat. So for members of this unit, that meant that they were not recognized as so-called veterans of the war, which meant that they did not have access to particular subsidies. They didn't have access to special support to address wartime damages, like losing property, although for most of the youth that wasn't necessarily relevant. But many of them had been severely traumatized. They had lost their whole families, and they could have used some extra support, I would say. But many of them didn't have access to that. And of course, they also weren't recognized in Soviet society as kind of full members of society, because the assumption was that they had just essentially waited out and let other people fight for them. Which, of course, is not true. I mean, the Zorin unit and the Bielski unit and a number of other of these so-called family units provided very, very important support for the combat. So in my analysis, I really think about both the repercussions of anti-Semitism in Soviet society that worked often with the stereotypes of Jews as not capable, as effeminate, as not capable of military struggle and so forth. But I also think about the impact of notions of gender, of how particular kinds of labor, and which what I describe here as reproductive labor, of providing food, providing medical aid, providing clothing, but also taking care of orphans, taking care of people who are abandoned, have lost their whole family, is not valued in the same way as the kind of very spectacular and visible kinds of resistance, like the partisan combat that blows up trains and kills German military. So in that sense, I'm ending kind of the book with a rumination on Soviet post-war memory and how it has excluded particular experiences, and in this case, of course, in particular Jewish experiences of the genocide. But I think also in other ways, you can transpose that to thinking about how generally civilian experience, or the experience of women, the experience of elderly, of children, are often written out of history when we think about how war is remembered and how societies think about war and what is important, where I actually think maintaining community, maintaining the very basic conditions for survival is equally important as defeating the enemy.
Right. It's a really fascinating analysis. Annika, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, I want to know what you are working on next.
Yeah, as I said earlier, I think some of the local communities that I've explored in this book are still a gap in Holocaust scholarship. So I'm still working on some of the more rural ghettos, but I'm also very interested and much more interested now in generally how local communities react to the German occupation. So issues of collaboration, local responses to persecution of Jews is something that I'm interested in. And related to that, I'm part of the Holocaust Geographies Collaborative, where we're trying to develop a database of Holocaust period ghettos all over Eastern Europe, which is a large undertaking. It will take a few years. But personally, also my major concern, my major project right now is actually to think about the aftermath of the Nazi genocide, in particular in Belarus after World War II. Because I think we still have a lot more to understand about how communities deal with the fact that 30 to 40% of their members are gone, that there's huge population losses. And to some extent, these people who have been killed are buried right outside of town. So what does it mean to live near these mass graves? But I'm also looking at the destruction of cultural heritage, in particular Jewish heritage, of course. And environmental destruction that has happened during the German occupation. So in other words, I'm trying to understand how did people rebuild the society after the war, and how did they deal with some of the divisions that had emerged during the occupation, but also how did they address some of the shared experiences of the German occupation terror, of hunger, of environmental destruction, and so forth. So I've been doing a lot more research in Belarus, concretely, recently visited many of these sites and a lot of archival research, kind of building off of my earlier work, if you will.
Yeah, it sounds like an appropriate sequel to this project. I look forward to reading it and to having you back on the show when it's out, hopefully.
That's great. I'll be happy to do that.
Well, Annika, it's been wonderful talking to you today. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Great. Take care. That was Professor Annika Valka joining us from Washington University in St. Louis. She was talking about her book, Pioneers and Partisans, an oral history of Nazi genocide in Belarusia. Thanks for listening.